Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Today, we've got the final part of our special month-long series, The 50-Year Fight, Solutions for Closing the Achievement Gap. We've been taking a look at what works in closing gaps in education, nationwide or in one district, or even what works in just one classroom. Well, last week, we talked with Natalie Wexler, the author of The Knowledge Gap, who talked about the focus on accountability and testing regimes instead of actual content and knowledge as one reason for the persistence of the achievement gap.
We're reinforcing existing inequities in society. And the intent is to help kids and help them to do better on these tests and do better in school. But we've basically been shooting ourselves in the foot for a long time.
Well, today we're going to look at one solution, perhaps the oldest and most divisive, but perhaps also one of the most effective. Kim Bridges, in Richmond, Virginia. She's in Richmond, Virginia. She's a former educator, a school board member, and a senior policy analyst at the Virginia Department of Education. She now teaches in the Department of Education and Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. And Bridges told us that she's looked at a lot of education policies, everything from pre-K to extending the school day. But there is one solution that she says is worth, above all, national and local effort.
I'm still a firm believer that the very biggest lever we can take on to address this gap is through school integration. Diverse, equitable, and inclusive school policies at the K-12 level are really necessary and have been the chapter of our nation's history in which we saw the most progress.
Well, we are 65 years after the historic Supreme Court decision on desegregation in Brown versus Board of Education. And yet, many school districts are more segregated than ever. So this hour on Point, rethinking desegregation as a solution to closing the achievement gap. And you can join us. What do you think about the idea that integrated schools might be the best solutions to giving every child an excellent education? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today from Atlanta, Georgia, with Shanika Williams. She's a professor of educational administration and policy at the University of Georgia's College of Education, where she studies the academic and social benefits of school desegregation. Professor Williams, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's lay it out really clearly. What is the evidence, or how ample is the evidence, that integrating schools closes achievement gaps?
There is some evidence there. I think we saw some of the best evidence in the 1980s, where we saw the gap narrow. But I'd also like to be very clear and say that, you know, integration is one way, but I am not exactly certain that it is the only way. Mm-hmm. And I say that because before schools were desegregated, majority black schools did not have the same resources. So I do say that integration is a way, but I also don't want to say for black children that the only way that they can have a great education is because they happen to be in a school with students who look different than they do. Mm. I think there are absolutely social benefits on both sides. I don't think we talk enough about that in the literature. We tend to have one way that we examine that. So there are definitely social benefits and academic benefits as well. But I don't want us to just think that solely school integration is the absolute only way.
Point taken. And in fact, our very first installment of this series on solutions to closing the achievement gap talked about resources and opportunity gaps writ more largely, right? We talked with Prudence Carter, the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Berkeley, about that. It's just that in the structure of a show like this, we kind of take things in discrete chunks. But Professor Williams, So tell me more about the social benefits, because you just said we don't talk about those enough. So what are they, and why are they so important?
So education is broad, right? It's more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. So there's an education to be gained by learning different cultures, learning about students whom you sit by in classes. Some of my work focuses on friendships, cross-racial friendships. What does it mean beyond having students simply be in class with one another or in a school that's desegregated? What do we know beyond that? There are definite benefits there. There's research that says being in school together with students of different races that often impacts college choice. It impacts neighborhood choice. So absolutely, there are academic benefits, but there are those social benefits that in the long term perpetuate themselves.
Mm. And they perpetuate themselves to the point where you're saying they positively perpetuate themselves.
Perpetuate themselves. So if you've been influenced in some way from being in an integrated setting, like I said, it probably is going to impact your college choice, where you choose to live in a neighborhood. And we know that we really can't talk about like school integration without talking about neighborhood integration. So that's what I mean. There is possibly a perpetuation effect.
So neighborhood integration, this is a really important thing to explore right now, because I think, there's a lot of evidence that that neighborhood integration is definitely not where it needs to be in the United States. And in fact, in many cities, or several cities, at least in the U.S., neighborhoods are more segregated than ever. So for as long as there's a push for neighborhood schools, are we in a de facto state where segregated schools are going to exist?
Without some serious intervention on housing policy, I would argue that probably so. I mean, when we look at housing prices, we'll take Atlanta metro area in particular. When we look at housing prices and property taxes and who can live where and where those schools are, and who's zoned to go to those schools, yes, that plays a definite role in school integration.
Okay. So then in the absence of those housing policies, there are policies to directly integrate schools. I mean, do they work?
They can work in some instances. So student assignment policies, how districts assign students to schools, there are districts that have shown some levels of success. I'll use Wake County, North Carolina, for example. For years, Wake County had a diversity policy that did work. But I will also say this. Wake County is an area where the socioeconomic status tends to work in its favor when we talk about balancing schools along racial and socioeconomic lines. If you have a district that is majority high poverty and high students of color, then it's going to be very different, very difficult, rather, to try and integrate those students. But there are areas around the country that are having some success of that, but it depends on district policy and the actual demographics of the district as a whole.
Wake County, North Carolina, was working, you said. For a time, it showed a lot of promise. Has that persisted?
I am not doing work in Wake right now,
okay.
But I will say this. At the last time I was conducting research there, school board elections were reshaping what was happening in Wake County. And so I can't speak today to exactly what's happening in Wake, but for years they did show levels of success.
Right. So, Professor Williams, I just want to take a step back and look at the historical battles. I think that's not too light a word, that have gone on regarding desegregation or integrating schools. I mean, in fact, those battles just raise their heads again in the context of the presidential election we are now all in, because in June, desegregation came to the forefront of the national conversation when Senator Kamala Harris of California challenged Vice President Joe Biden about his early opposition to federal busing, his early opposition to busing early in his political career. So here's their exchange from a Democratic debate.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Joe Biden there. Professor Williams, I wanted to play that clip because I just want to ask you, have we, in our national understanding of school integration, have we gotten at all beyond the conflict over busing?
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
I am not exactly sure to tell you the truth. Yeah. Here's what I really think. I think when we talk about school integration at large, I think what we see around the country is that individual will often trumps community will. Meaning, if you interview a group of parents and ask them if integrated schools matter to them, I would argue that they would say, yes, that matters. I want my child to go to school with children of different races, learn about different cultures. But if you ask them to what extent they're willing to make efforts, then the response isn't quite on par. And I think this is the heart of this larger conversation. What do individuals want versus what is for the greater good?
What are you getting at there? Are you getting at that when?
What I am getting at is racism is quite endemic in this country. And I don't even think that some parents think it is racist when they say, I want X for my child, because they feel that they have that right for their child. So I would argue that it's difficult. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is difficult. And again, individual will often trumps.
But isn't this one of the core reasons why there has been so much resistance to integrating schools, that there is, whether it's correct or not, this presumption, unconscious presumption, that it may signify gains for some students but losses for others? That's kind of at the heart of it, isn't it?
Well, it depends on the way in which it is done. Oftentimes, school integration... Well, let me back up. If you go back to
Professor Williams, we have to take a quick break in 20 seconds, and I don't want to cut you off in mid-thought, so I'll let you pick it up when we come back. We are talking about desegregation as one solution to close achievement gaps. This is part four of our special month-long series on solutions to the 50-year fight, as we're calling it. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about desegregation as a potential solution to closing the achievement gap. This is the fourth and final part of our special month-long series called The 50-Year Fight, Solutions to Closing the Achievement Gap. And I'm joined today by Shanika Williams. She's professor of educational administration and policy at the University of Georgia's College of Education. She studies the academics and social benefits of school desegregation. And Professor Williams, before the break, we were talking about, you were answering my question about the presumption that some people may have that when schools are integrated, it means gains for some students and losses for others. And I had to cut you off because we had to take a quick break there. But I want you to pick up on your answer to that.
Yes, I just wanted to go back. And even if we think back before Brown, here's where I think this conversation about school integration often falls flat. the onus of desegregation legally and integration in practice has often fallen on one group. That is, back in the Brown days, I'm talking black children versus white children. The onus for desegregation was on the backs of black people primarily. And so therefore, when we talk about whether or not integration is working, I don't think we talk about it as a bidirectional exchange of some sort. And so when some groups feel like I've had to leave what I've known to integrate to something that appears better, then what I've had must not have been good enough, right? And that I see as a problem. I still see it today. So integration can work, but both parties have to feel equally invested.
Well, interesting, because we, in the process of reporting for this series, we talked to James Ford. He's a member of the North Carolina State Board of Education, a former North Carolina Teacher of the Year, been a very strong advocate for school desegregation, particularly in the Charlotte public schools, where he was a high school teacher. And when we talked to him, he drew on his own experience participating in a desegregation program when he was a student in Rockford, Illinois. And here's what James Ford told us.
I was able to benefit from some token integration tactics and, you know, got bused across town to a primarily white school. But you immediately see the stark difference between not just the resources, the level of expectation and instruction, but just the overall, just the air felt different.
So he also said, though, that desegregation had a potential downside. And Professor Williams, this is reflecting on what you just said, that downside being that more needs to be done to create truly integrated school communities, and that getting students of different races into the same building simply wasn't enough.
You, as a kid, you see the contrast, just like, you know, the Clark Dow study, right? It's like, oh, well, people who look like me, right, they go to these schools, and people who look like them go to these schools. So what does that say about who I am? So you wear that.
Professor Williams, when you heard James Ford there say, what does that say about who I am? What do you make of that?
You know, what I make of that is the loss of black teachers and leaders. And what James probably did not see in his new school. You know, we still have not gained the numbers back of black teachers and leaders before school desegregation. And I think that hurts in some ways, particularly for children of color. And I want to be clear, I am not saying that a non-black teacher or leader cannot do well by black students. That is not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that loss of not seeing people who look like you and can relate to you in some way, or you feel that, I think that's a cost that students of color have felt in some integrated settings.
Well, we're going to hear from another voice with a different perspective on desegregation in just a second, but there's a lot of response on our phone lines to this, Professor Williams. So let me just go to Marilyn, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. I have a long experience being part of the integrated program in Buffalo, New York, where I went to school. But then one of the biggest differences, and I became successful, and I achieved a lot for education. But when I turned and looked around me, most of the people who started with me never finished. And I was wondering what was going on. And I was seeing the difference on what my parents did and what their parents didn't do, or what how I took the education and what I added to my education so I can be successful. And I agree with Professor Williams a bit, because the educational system being integrated is not really truly integrated. The whole curriculum was segregated. The process of how they place students in certain particular schools was a segregated policy. And then when we dealt with job opportunities and going trying to buy houses and things like that, that was a segregated process. And so then you go in and you succeed and you come out. And it just happened that my name doesn't particularly identify me as an African-American, so I could kind of hide in the folds. And many times people came up and looked at me and said, she's a black. And I said to myself, what's going on here? And it's because that system that's in place to segregate is so strong, it doesn't matter what the school is doing, because you're going to get chopped off somewhere down the line.
Well, Marilyn, thank you so much for your call and your experience as an educator as well. Professor Williams, hang on here for just a moment, because I want to turn now to Chris Stewart, joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's a longtime education activist focused on school choice and the Black experience in America's public schools. CEO of Education Post, a media project of the Results in Education Foundation, which supports charter schools and school accountability, and also a former member of the Minneapolis Public Schools Board of Education. Chris Stewart, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, take us straight to this question, your answer to the question that we're asking throughout this series. Do you think desegregation or integrating public schools is a good way, an effective way to close achievement gaps in America?
I think it's the right goal and always has been. I just think that the problem has been that the remedies to get there have been time and time again wrong. They have done more damage in a lot of cases than they have done good. So I don't know that it's the most effective way to close the achievement gap. I think the most effective way to close the achievement gap are the educational interventions we've always known about, which are, you know, great teaching, great teachers, instruction, curriculum, school leadership, educational science, not sociology, you know, instead of using those type of remedies. I do think that it's what you do in school and in classrooms that makes the difference.
Uh-huh. Well, you heard Professor Williams a little earlier make two points. One was that integration in and of itself doesn't solve the problem of a lack of resources in schools that are majority student of color. Would you agree with that, that we would also have to continue to focus on supporting those other schools as well?
I mean, there's research right now that basically tells you for the Black population, at least 50% of our kids now are in the suburbs. So it's this idea that we're all in segregated urban areas doesn't hold as much as it used to. And we're learning some things about our kids of color and Black kids that are in so-called integrated schools. And no, it is not a panacea. They don't instantly get everything that they need, and the schools that they leave lose a lot. Like, we're learning that in Hartford. Hartford has a two-tiered education system, those that get into the magnet schools and those who don't. And the ones that get into the magnet schools have all these extra resources, and it's amazing. And the 50% of the Hartford kids that don't get into those schools now are more segregated than they were before this integration experiment took place.
Hmm. Well, I think if I heard Professor Williams a couple of minutes ago, if I heard her correctly, she was also saying that thus far, or at least historically, integration efforts have been largely one way, right? It's getting students of color into schools that were predominantly white. I mean, would you agree with that, Chris Stewart? Is that what you were saying as well?
I think it's an amazing point. It's one that actually we should all pay attention to, is that the integration experiment, as we have seen it up until this time, actually put the onus on Black families. And they lost a lot in that process. All of the Black educational capital that was built up before 1954 was lost after 1954 and never recovered. And we pretend that there was no value in what was going on in those Black schools prior to Brown, and that's just not the case. There's lots of research about the amazing work that was being done, and there were lots of gaps that were being closed even in schools that didn't have the same resources. So I think she's absolutely right. If we were to do integration properly and in a way that's just and humane this time, the entire onus would have to be on white or more affluent families to do the moving, to have their schools closed, to have their children moved to schools that really need their social capital. That would be the most just and effective way to make it work this time.
Frankly speaking, do you think that that's possible at all?
No. I mean, that's what makes this whole discussion frustrating. The most frustrating part about it is there are longstanding educational interventions that we know do make a difference and do work with kids. And we have this integration vanity project that's taken hold amongst many progressives and many in the educational community that I feel like is a major distraction. It It is. I don't think it's going to happen soon, not within the next year, 5 years, 10 years, that schools are going to be integrated racially or economically. So what do we do in the meantime for kids that are not going to be in these magic magnet schools that haven't shown up, by the way, anytime soon, won't be showing up anytime soon?
Well, Professor Williams, you've been listening patiently here, and I appreciate that. Would you like to respond to what Chris Stewart is saying? He called it an integration vanity project.
No, I would just like to say I absolutely agreed with what he is saying. That's just where I am with it. I absolutely agree to Chris's point on where we are with integration and if we'll get there. But I think I'm not certain that that is the goal. If I believed that if that were the goal for most individuals, then I would say, yes, we will get there. I am not certain that that is the goal of the public.
Truly integrated schools.
Truly integrated schools.
Chris Stewart, you want to respond to that?
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, there's a big difference between what people say and what people do. And I think I heard the professor say earlier, you know, if you ask families, especially in focus groups, if diversity matters and integration matters in their school choices, they will say absolutely. The majority will say yes. It's almost a social stigma to not say yes to that. What they actually do when they enroll their kids is a lot of administrative jujitsu to get their kids into schools that create the greatest social distance between their kids and kids that they think are on the out groups. And that is just, it's the behavioral economics or the racial physics of school enrollment, of how people buy their houses, choose their schools. So if we are waiting for that to correct itself before we get down to the serious business of restoring the educational capital that once existed to teach black and brown kids, we're in real trouble.
So Professor Williams and Chris Stewart, I have to say, this is a really interesting moment for us right here on the show, because we entered this hour wanting to wrestle with this question about if desegregation or integrating schools is an effective and important way to close, quote unquote, achievement gaps in America. And I feel like I'm hearing both of you say that theoretically speaking, yes. But practically speaking, it's not going to happen in America. And if that is the case, then, Professor Williams, let me first turn to you on this. If that is the case, then how do we – should we be reframing this discussion on what desegregation ought to look like in America? Should we be asking a different question entirely? I mean, how does this notion of having integrated schools play into or factor – how should it factor into providing an excellent education for all children?
You know, I think we have to start with the basics of teaching and learning. And if I may, I'm teaching a Brown versus Board of Education course right now at the University of Georgia for graduate students. And we wrestle with these conversations every week. I also had the pleasure of reading, and you should read it if you have not, Sonia Douglas Horsford's Who's School Integration? Mm. And I want to answer your question by reading something briefly from W.E.B. Du Bois in 1935, where he wrote, to sum up this, theoretically, the Negro needs neither segregated schools nor mixed schools. What he needs is education. What he must remember is that there is no magic either in mixed schools or in segregated schools. And I just wanted to say that to answer the question. There is no magic, but there is good teaching. There are parents who are engaged in schools that need to understand how to engage certain groups of parents, right? Not wait to the parent for the parent to show up at the school, but go actually to the parent. So I just think we have to go back to the basics. It reminds me of my education. I was educated in rural Alabama, Coffeyville Elementary School, where all we had was a chalkboard and the risograph machine, you know, the copy machine that printed with purple ink. Mm-hmm. I thought we had everything. I didn't know that according to the nation and to the world, I was receiving a subpar education. But you know why I thought we had everything? Because we had great teachers who made us believe that we could do anything and compete with anybody in the world. So do on its face, I support integrated schools. I absolutely do. But if we get bogged down and wishing what public might not be interested in, we have to go back to the basics of good teaching and learning, regardless of race or income.
Well, Chris Stewart, I only have you for another minute here, and I just wanted to ask you, your kids, if I understand correctly, your kids go to an integrated school. Is that right?
So that's right.
Are they gaining a benefit from that experience that they otherwise would not have?
I think so, because, you know, in the last week, I have a son that didn't want to go to school this morning because he's been depressed for 4 days because last week a group of white kids wouldn't stop using the word. And when he asked them to stop using that word, they told him white people invented it, so it was theirs. This is an integrated school, 50-50, economically and racially integrated. Some of the same kids told gas chamber jokes, which I'm amazed by. And this is a middle school. And one of the jokes is quite obviously the worst anti-Semitic joke I've ever heard in my life. And this is at an integrated school. So yeah, they have gained something I think they wouldn't gain if maybe I chose a different school.
Well, Chris Stewart, longtime education activist focused on school choice and the Black experience in America's public schools. Thank you so much for joining us. And I do have to just say I apologize to listeners there. Didn't anticipate Mr. Stewart using that word there. But I take your point that in the context, it was probably your choice to use it. But Chris Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today is the last in our special four-part series this month called The 50-Year Fight, Solutions for Closing the Achievement Gap. And we're taking a look at whether integrating schools, whether desegregation is an effective and important way to close gaps in American education. And I'm joined today by Shanika Williams. She's a professor of education administration and policy at the University of Georgia's College of Education. And in the process of putting together this series, we put out a survey to On Point listeners about what they think about the various aspects of the achievement gap. We got about 900 responses, and just want to walk you through some of the results here. About 27% of the responses were from the Northeast, 22% from the Midwest, 17% from the Southeast, et cetera. But more importantly, 81% of the respondents said that racial diversity in schools should be a priority, but just 27% of them said they had participated in integration policies such as busing or redistricting, or that their children had participated. And of those who had participated in integration policies themselves, or whose children have, about 60% reported that those policies were not effective, that the schools in their communities remained segregated and inequitable. So that's from a survey of 900 respondents that we put out to On Point listeners. Let's go quickly to Teddy, who's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Teddy, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I was born in 63 in Yellow Springs and went to a very, very diverse school district exempted from the state. Like my graduating class was 60 some kids, and I grew up with most of them throughout the 70s and graduated in 81. And it was very diverse. My best friend was from Cuba. The neighbors were from Japan. There were lots of black and brown and multicolored kids. And we understood, and my first cousins, by the way, are from South Africa, so they're black. So it all just seemed like all the problems had been solved. But you could also get a job in Yellow Springs. And now the only jobs in Yellow Springs are like service jobs to very, very wealthy people. So a very conservative effort has been made to change Yellow Springs into kind of like a touristy area, where you really can't get a job in manufacturing or anything like that. And I have no idea how diverse the school district is anymore. But some of my friends that still live in Yellow Springs, you know, they're serving drinks.
Right. Teddy,
you know,
thank
you. They're waiting tables.
Yeah, Teddy, thank you so much for your call. So Shanika Williams, again, it makes perfect sense to me. I see why we keep circling back to the broader issues outside the schoolhouse in and of itself when it comes to equity in America, that we cannot have this conversation, and we won't, in isolation. But did you want to just respond to what Teddy was sharing about his personal experience?
Well, what I hear from Teddy is that although there was a very diverse environment, maybe that didn't benefit some students in the ways in which he thought they had because of the economy of the place. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing some of that in rural areas. Well, actually all over the country, but it's probably, I would argue, a bit more pervasive in some rural contexts in which the schools are diverse. Students are finishing high school at a very high rate, going to college at a very low rate. And then there's no job opportunity for the families. So I would just say, yeah, this is all tied. It's all tied together, right?
Yeah.
Economics, education, policy, you can't talk about one without talking about the other.
So, Professor Williams, forgive me. I'm going to keep coming back to this because I just want to really be sure that I understand clearly where we should be centering this conversation. Because, you know, we heard Chris Stewart before the break. It seemed to me that he was basically saying or getting at a point where Is there a criticism of efforts to desegregate schools that say by focusing on desegregation, we are not paying closer attention to these other issues that might have a much larger, more positive impact on children of color? I mean, resources, economics, housing, that kind of thing.
I don't. Let me see. Here's what I want to say to that. I don't think that by focusing on integration, we're lessening other arguments. I think that there's a value added to discussing both, right? If you're wanting to talk about integrating schools, then let's talk about integrating a workforce, right? Let's talk about reducing so that we can reduce the wealth gap in this country so that we can affect housing policy. So I just think there are so many issues that are interconnected here that is why it's so complex.
Yeah.
Let me just say it like that.
Well, so the reason why I'm asking, and we're going to hear from a district that's truly trying to fully integrate its schools in just a second. But the reason why I'm asking here, and look, this is live radio across the country, so people are just hearing me struggle, is that we talked about a minute ago how if desegregation is really going to work to the benefit of all students, it has to be a really authentic integration, right? Not just one way, but that both you and Chris Stewart said you don't actually see that as a political possibility or a potential political reality. That's why I'm struggling here a little bit.
Well, let me give you an example. If you go inside a school,
yes, please,
that is integrated, it's like a pie, 25, 25, 25, 25 different races. Go into an advanced math class. Go into see who's on the student government. Oftentimes, schools are desegregated or integrated, but then there's also tracking within the schools that affects students' educational opportunity. So I just think it's so multifaceted. On its face, is it ideal or should it be ideal? I would argue yes. But there are so many things that are happening in school and out of school that makes this a difficult reality. I think that's why Chris and I are struggling with it as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like we know on the surface, it would be perfect. But if it never gets there, we cannot get bogged down on what we wish for and a whole group of students continue to not get an equitable education in this country.
Yeah. Well, let's turn now to San Antonio, Texas. And Mohammed Chowdhury joins us from there. Mohammed is Chief Innovation Officer at San Antonio Independent School District, leading an effort to open dozens of, quote, diverse by design schools in the San Antonio School District. By the way, that's a district that serves more than 50,000 students. More than 90% of them are considered economically disadvantaged, nearly 98% of them are students of color. Mohammed Chowdhury, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So what does diverse by design mean in San Antonio?
Essentially, what it means is that we have, in addition to trying to figure out how to make high-poverty schools well, one of the things that we have committed to is not recreating the segregation that we have, especially as we expand options for our families. So we are also a district that allows for choice beyond your neighborhood attendance zone. And so one of the things that we set out to do as we built out our choice system, we decided to ensure that some of these schools would be located all throughout the city and would be integrated by design, essentially ensuring integrated learning environments was also something happening in San Antonio while we also figured out how to, disrupt poverty and bring educational opportunity in our segregated learning environments as well. The vast majority of our system is segregated. We have 17 different school districts that make up one city. The median income of our footprint is $30,000. But we're surrounded by affluence, that's no doubt. And so using our choice system to decouple housing and educational opportunity has been very important to us. And so we do that through what we call a controlled choice framework, which essentially ensures that we can build integrated learning environments and make sure that opportunity is available to all students throughout the city as one of our many strategies that we are utilizing
for our
district.
Okay, so Mohammed, clarify something for me. As I read these stats about the San Antonio Independent School District, 90% socioeconomically disadvantaged students, 98% students of color. When you say you're surrounded by wealth, does this diverse by design idea, is it connecting with other communities outside of the San Antonio Independent School District? I mean, how are you generating that diversity?
Yeah. Okay. So one thing to know is we do have a history of white flight. Like many other cities, we have families that have opted out to the charter sector or the private school sector. But in terms of the surrounding suburbs, they're just like a 15-10 minute drive. And so one of the things that we've done, and a good portion of our employees don't even live in our district borders, is open up our borders through our school choice initiative. So the vast majority of the seats in these schools remain for our in-district families, but we also have out-of-district set-asides to introduce socioeconomic diversity into these schools as well. So yes, at scale, in order to be able to produce and pull families to tap into integrated learning environments, we've had to open up our borders and disrupt the segregated districts that were built, going back all the way down to redlining and up.
And has there been positive response from your neighboring districts?
I think yes and no, right? Many of our families, I can show you, geocoded maps of applications and student enrolled families are coming from, an affluent suburb and opting out and sending their kids to one of our schools in downtown. And I think we also have families also opting out of high poverty school districts and coming into our system as well. So I don't think anyone wants to ever lose students, but there is this system that is set up with 17 different school districts, along with all kinds of other things. When you look at the legacy of discrimination and opportunity in the city, where there is this scarcity mindset created, and we continue to tie, our enrollment to funding, just like most states. And mm-hmm. So in order to be able to open up opportunity, we do have to open up our borders to be able to serve the city and ensure that not only are we a financially sustainable district, but we are also opening up economic diversity into a district border that was never drawn to encompass it in the first place.
Well, Mohammed Chowdhury, Chief Innovation Officer at the San Antonio Independent School District, joining us from San Antonio, Texas. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a quick call from Flo, who's calling from Peachtree City, Georgia. Flo, you're on the air.
Awesome. This is a very amazing discussion, and I'm grateful that we're having it. I grew up in Boston area, and it was pretty homogenous, mostly, I think, 98% white, the school system that I grew up in. I happen to be an African-American female, and I did not see another African-American or a really diverse child at all until fourth grade. And there was a program called METCO, mm-hmm. which was a busing program that kids from the Boston area went into the school systems. And I think that integration or desegregation can work as long as the families that are being integrated in there, that there's involvement with the parents, and if there's any behavioral challenges, because sometimes that did happen, and the kids that did have behavioral issues where the parents didn't have the buy-in for the school culture, they did not last. However, students that were bused in, if they were really integrated, I mean, in the sports and the after-school opportunities, pretty much every kid went to college and is successful today, yeah. no matter what race from that particular school. It was very intentional, and the parents had to have the buy-in.
Right. Well, Flo, thank you so much for your call. And just a point of clarification there, the METCO program in Massachusetts typically allows students from inside of Boston access through busing to districts outside of Boston, to suburban districts outside of Boston. But to Flo's point there, it also requires a lot of parental involvement as well. But let's go to Joanne, who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi. Very complex issue. My feeling as I listen to this is that we have a complete, our society here is so segregated. We have gentrification things going on, which is basically a way of saying we're going to kick out all of the people who don't have the income that the white folks in this area do. And my feeling is let's just take the thing to just what is it we want for our children, and not people will use that and say, well, I just want my child to have the best education. I'm not against integration, which is not true. What you say here, we say is then, why isn't the black schools, why are they not better than they are? I mean, let's make them the focus. Let's make the schools the focus, that they are such wonderful schools that the white folks are going, wait a minute, I'd rather go to that school because they have the resources and they're doing the arts and they're doing stuff.
Right.
And there's a little bit of that going on because I've taught at a very white school in Columbia County, but after I retired, I started teaching in elementary schools, and I teach the arts. And so I went.
Joanna, you're going to have to forgive me here. I'm so sorry to have to cut you off there, but we really only have 90 seconds left in the show, and I want to turn back to Professor Shanika Williams. But Joanne, thank you for your call. Professor Williams, you heard Joanne there calling again to put additional resources into schools that may serve predominantly children of color. We have a minute left here, Professor Williams, and we've been spending Mondays this month trying to wrestle with this big question about what works and closing gaps. So would you just give us a closing thought here on where you think localities or even the nation you choose ought to be focusing its efforts if we're going to really make some forward strides on this major issue in American education?
I would argue for equity and resources. And when I say resources, I'm saying that schools that have high numbers of students of color and high numbers of students in poverty normally have teachers that might not be quite as effective or high quality. So let's invest in teacher resources, leader resources, because actually money only matters if you use it in a way that really impacts teaching and learning. And I think we have to start with the teachers and leaders across the board.
Well, Shanika Williams is a professor of education administration at the University of Georgia's College of Education. Professor Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in a sense, we have come full circle on this question of investing in schools. That's where we started our four-part series. So go to onpointradio.org to listen to every part of our series, The 50-Year Fight, Solutions for Closing the Achievement Gap. It was produced, by the way, by Grace Tatter. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.